Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on a very important topic, the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The FCRA has become a more popular statute lately for plaintiff's attorneys, and more collection agencies are being sued for alleged FCRA violations. While on top of that, there have also been some recent regulatory changes that have affected how collection agencies should be complying with the law. We're fortunate to have a pair of compliance experts with us today who will share their insights and best practices with us. This webinar is being generously sponsored by LexisNexis Risk Solutions. You'll get the chance to hear from them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Dennis J. Barton III is the managing attorney of the Barton Law Group, LLC. He specializes in collection litigation in Missouri and Illinois and nationwide consumer law defense. Dennis graduated from the Indiana University School of Business in 1996 and the Washington University School of Law in 2003. He is the president of the Missouri Collectors Association and the ACA State Compliance Chair for the state of Missouri. Dennis is also a member of ACA's MAP Committee and an ACA certified instructor that presents nationwide on collection strategies, defense tactics, and compliance. Leslie Bender spent more than 30 years handling compliance, regulatory, transactional, and legal matters for hospitals and financial services companies. Recognized as a national expert on HIPAA and other information privacy and security laws, she was one of the first privacy officers internationally accredited as a certified information privacy professional. Currently, Leslie is the Chief Strategy Officer and General Counsel for BCA Financial Services, a Miami, Florida headquartered financial services company. She is past president of ACA International, having served as ACA's president in 2013-2014, and as an officer of its board of directors from 2011 through 2015. She earned her undergraduate degree from Northwestern University and her Juris Doctorate degree from the University of Notre Dame. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by myself. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them either as the discussion is ongoing or when the discussion is concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. There is no PowerPoint component or visual component to today's webinar. It is just a discussion. So if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing anything. Finally, because we're going to be talking about some compliance and legal topics today, let me read the following disclaimer. This information is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. And the opinions expressed are the opinions of the speaker and not his or her organization. Whew, now I can breathe. With that, let's get right to our discussion. The first topic we're going to talk about today is Senate Bill 2155, or also known as the Economic Growth Regulatory Relief and Consumer Protection Act. Try and fit that on a grain of rice. Let me start with you, Dennis. Maybe you can walk us through that law and how it sort of fits in with the FCRA.
Sure. Well, the biggest point of this law was to allow people to put security freezes on their credit. In today's day of, we have a lot of consumer ID theft out there, and a good way to prevent that is to, or to combat that, is to put a freeze on your credit. Well, that's what one of the big parts of that law, at least how it addresses our industry. And going to the FCRA, Fair Credit Reporting Act, the law asked for that to be incorporated into the FCRA, and it also applies to changing the model form for the Summary of Consumer Identity Theft Rights and the Summary of Consumer Rights under the appendices I and K to Regulation V, which, obviously that's what the BCFP uses. So we're talking about a security freeze overall. Leslie, do you have any thoughts on that? Anything I missed?
seen over the years a number of state legislatures try to grapple with the idea of what are things that can be done to help reduce the incidence of identity theft. And so some of the states have attempted credit freeze laws as well. And I think that it just sort of becomes pretty complicated as mobile as folks are today. So this was an attempt at the federal level to try to address this. And in this Congress, there also are some bills that are attempting to effectively preempt the states from doing different things with respect to credit reporting or identity theft or data security incidents. So it'll be interesting to see in the new Republican-dominated Senate and the Democratic-dominated House if there might be some middle ground for this to get some traction next year.
And Mike? Security freeze, what it does not do, it does not apply to collection agencies who are acting on behalf of themselves or their clients when they're trying to request information for the purposes of reviewing an account or for the purposes of collecting on an account. Reviewing an account pursuant to the law includes account maintenance, monitoring, credit line increases, and account upgrades and enhancements. So just because someone puts a credit freeze on their account doesn't mean that you can't report or cannot see the credit reporting history of that individual.
So then let me ask and try and triangulate what this means for the ARM industry. How are collection agencies expected to manage, react, or handle an instance where they're trying to collect on a debt and someone says, oh, I've got a freeze on my credit? Is there something different they should be doing?
Not really. When it comes to the credit freeze, that's going to apply more to lending institutions, for example, and their inability to then extend credit, because if there's a freeze on the account, they can't extend credit. That's how they're combating the identification theft, issue. So, but from an agency standpoint, because it does not affect our ability to review and to report, I'm not sure there's a big impact on us. Now, Leslie, from a compliance standpoint, what do you think?
I would have to agree with you, Dennis. I think that it was drawn intentionally not to have an impact. So back to Mike's question, I don't know that we will see too much of an impact, but that doesn't mean that but I guess we'll just have to wait to see the future history. This just took effect in September.
Well, Leslie, that's an excellent point. In fact, Natalie, when you say we'll need to see how consumers handle it, as a litigation attorney, I think of, well, how is a plaintiff's attorney going to handle it? Even more, or maybe even AG offices, but primarily it's plaintiff's attorneys. And how does the creative plaintiff's attorney looking to score the next big theory try to turn this into an issue for our industry? And sadly, I don't know how that could happen at this point. There could be an issue saying that if you, I don't know, I don't want to speculate, but I'm sure the creative plaintiff's attorneys will find a way to try. But when they do, that's when we will have to.
That's when you get creative with your defenses, right?
Right, and I'm sorry. I know that part of the point of this is to try to help mitigate that, but unfortunately, I don't see a real opening for a claim against an agency at this point.
There was a question that came in on this topic, so I thought we'd maybe try and address it now. In terms of credit reporting, does anything change if someone has a freeze on their account or if someone claims to have a freeze on their account? Is there anything different that an agency should be doing when it reports?
I don't think so. The law is very specific in that that the security freeze does not apply to collection. I mean, it uses the phrase collection agencies and stating that, in reporting the account or maintaining the account or updating it, that, you know, the freeze should not have an effect, which is important because, you know, if someone calls in for a dispute and they say, I'm disputing this, well, if they have an account freeze, a security freeze, I should say, if that enabled us, if that, you know, if that prohibited us from updating the account, well, then we've got a huge problem, right? Because now we are moving forward with a misrepresentation of the account. So fortunately, the security freeze does not apply to that.
Okay. I know the bill or the addresses a couple of other areas related to credit reporting, such as how to handle disputes filed by veterans related to medical debt, as well as other changes for handling and reporting medical debts of veterans and senior citizens. Let's see, is there anything else within there that, you know, collection agencies or the ARM industry in general should be aware of and on top of?
Well, I think that there are always populations of Americans that deserve sort of extra scrutiny and extra attention and extra caution. And those groups tend to be, older Americans, veterans, or active duty military, or their family members, and potentially also people who incurred some involuntary debt or medical debt. And as we all know, many of the attorney generals joined together, I think in 2015, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, to sign a compact with hospitals about the transparency of billing and collection practices. And there have been quite a number of attempts federally to come up with some type of legislation to address the difference between voluntary debt, like I went out and got a Best Buy Visa card so that I could get a big screen TV for watching Notre Dame and Clemson, or versus I had home and I certainly wouldn't have planned that. So it is a good idea to keep an eye on what is happening on the Hill. I think generally speaking, very vigilant caution about, the Service Persons Act and whether we are dealing with people who are in active duty military. Many businesses have special policies and procedures that provide extra protection for them. So perhaps adding a step preventively where you would scrub for active duty military or veteran status, or something of that nature might help you to identify individuals that fall into what are probably higher regulatory scrutiny groups. Is that helpful? Dennis, yeah, do you want to?
Absolutely. Thank you. At this point, I just wanted to pause the discussion briefly, and I'd like to invite Linda Straub-Jones from LexisNexis Risk Solutions to say a few words. Linda?
Oh, thank you so much, Mike, and thanks again to Dennis and Leslie for your expertise on today's call. We really appreciate it. As many of you know, LexisNexis Risk Solutions supports the credit and collections industry through its comprehensive database of information on individuals and businesses. The information we compile comes from over 10,000 sources and enables us to provide access to over 280 million consumers and 48 million businesses. Something that you may not know about LexisNexis is that we consider many data elements used by collectors to be covered under the FCRA, things such as bankruptcy, criminal, court records, even active military. What this means is an extra layer of protection for consumers, giving them the opportunity to request a copy of the information we have about them, and giving them the additional opportunity to correct the information that may be incorrect. So we abide by some of the same re-verification requirements of the FCRA that the bureaus abide by. As we're hearing today from Dennis and Leslie, the regulations continue to impact the collections industry, and we hope that you choose LexisNexis as a data provider who takes the extra steps needed to protect consumers. Thanks again, Mike, and back to you.
Thank you, and thanks again to LexisNexis Risk Solutions for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate your interest in providing information that helps educate the entire ARM industry. We had another question come in that I'd like to address before we move on to our next topic. And the question is about recent developments that allow for a 7-year block on reporting with instances of suspected fraud. This questioner says all the consumer has to do is to submit an affidavit and then runs out the statute of limitations, basically. Leslie or Dennis, do you want to take that one?
Go ahead, Leslie.
Okay. What we have seen in recent years are a number of creative opportunities that consumers and credit repair organizations and others have taken advantage of that are probably at odds with how people thought things would be when the Fair Credit Reporting Act was originally enacted. I have to laugh. Fair Credit Reporting Act is now considered to be the granddaddy of all of the privacy laws, but I'm not so sure that that was originally what was necessarily implied. So there are a number of practices that some credit reporting agencies have to be compliant with the FCRA's red flags rule, for example, which relate to prevention or detection of identity theft. So if a consumer downloads the Federal Trade Commission's identity theft affidavit and sends it in or gets a police report, potentially then by operation of the red flags rule under the FCRA, the person could potentially block something from being listed in their credit file, or it could be listed with a note. Other things along those lines that we have seen in recent years with respect to medical debt, back to medical debt, is that if medical debt is a small balance medical debt, several of the credit reporting agencies may delete upon receipt of a dispute on a small balance medical account, but they are not necessarily published policies that the CRAs have for doing that, nor is the logic or consistency of them something that I have yet been able to decode. So, for example, sometimes we get a complaint from a consumer that they are working with Credit Karma, and Credit Karma was able to get TransUnion to delete an item. Why are we preventing Equifax from doing that? I mean, obviously, we don't, as a data furnisher, have any control over that. So I think there are a lot of undocumented processes or practices that happen. And I guess in the greater scheme of things, if somebody has gone to the time and trouble of availing themselves of a direct dispute to a CRA on a small balance medical account or putting together an identity theft affidavit, is that an account that your operations people are going to want to apply a lot of resources to collecting, or might it be something best to just leave to the side and move on to other accounts?
Dennis?
I'm sorry, I had the mute thing turned on. I'm sorry, typically when I see the fraud stuff comes in when I'm doing collections, people say, well, that's not mine. Somebody stole my identity. I would think I'd hear a lot more than I do. But from a credit reporting standpoint, usually it's flagged. It's not blocked. And so from a statute of limitations, we're still able to sue on those. And from the 7-year block on the reporting, though, again, I'm more familiar with it being flagged rather than blocked. And I think, Leslie, you made some good points.
Excellent. Let's move on to our next topic, and that's how the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection is asking companies to comply with the FCRA by adopting some new and different disclosure forms. Dennis, maybe you can walk us through that.
Well, asking for new disclosure forms. Leslie might be a better source for that information. I've not seen those.
And I think that this is all sort of, the issue is whether there are sufficient disclosures. Are we disclosing what consumers can do to avail themselves of a freeze, and all types of debt may or may not be covered by them. For example, many of the disclosures that are required under the Fair Credit Reporting Act tie back to whether you have a pure credit agreement. So everybody probably remembers the famous Pintos decision. Eyes from credit agreements, and all debt isn't subject to the FCRA in the same way. So there might be disclosures that you need to make in regard to card or financial, true financial transactions with a true loan agreement or similar credit grantor agreement that may not apply to parking fines, library fines, medical bills, and things EFP has done recently, is they have released some findings about credit reporting and the collection of telco debt. As you know, there has been a significant shift in the focus and the approach of the Bureau since Cordray left. And by the way, Cordray believed that the only people who should be furnishing data were the people who actually owned the debt, whether being original creditors or subsequent debt buyers. And now, you know, Mick Mulvaney, and we're waiting to see if the Senate is going to confirm the new director. So we have seen a pretty significant shift to a strict constructionist. So this report on credit reporting and the collection of telco debt is very interesting. Generally speaking, telecommunications companies don't necessarily fit easily into the categories of people that are regulated by the CFP. However, their debt collectors and any purchasers of the debt may be. So very interesting, in the new report released by the Bureau, some of the key findings were that about 22% of consumers' credit reports include a telco-related expense from between 2013 and 2018. So even though consumers are paying for their telecom services, most of the providers don't report to the credit reporting agencies unless an account is in collections. So 95% of the telecom-related items were collection items. So I think that's pretty interesting. And the medium collection balance is $408, with very few, less than a fifth of them, being over $1,000. So the Bureau is very interested in what telecom debt does to consumers' credit scores. So this is an area to keep an eye to see if the Bureau is going to take some type of action. Historically, we have seen that the Bureau starts mentioning things in public speeches, mentioning things in bulletins, mentioning things in their supervisory reports and other reports. So for anybody on the call who is involved in the telecom, the collection of telecom debt, I would keep a close eye, and this might be a good time behind the scenes to be sort of refining and fine-tuning your back office processes for checking the accuracy of any telecom debts you are reporting. And further, making sure that you have really rigorous investigation processes in place, that you notice any bizarre trends of errors or increased disputes for any telecom, clients that you have, and that you make sure that your telecom clients are well aware that this appears to be a focal point for the Bureau. I don't know if any of the people on this call have experienced civil investigative requests made of collection agencies servicing telecom debt. And the Bureau has focused a lot of energy, even in this sort of deregulatory era, on this area.
And as the focus of the regulatory grows, so does the increase in probability of civil action. So, it's usual that plaintiff's attorneys, again, as we've talked about earlier, the creative ones especially, will see the new regulatory changes or regulatory trends and then try to convert that into a civil trend. So as the emphasis on telecommunications reporting grows, so will the interest in telecommunication litigation grow.
And speaking of litigation, there have been a remarkable number of Fair Credit Reporting Act class actions in a weird area of the FCRA that maybe we might not expect. But to the extent that we are employers and we prospectively may be doing some sort of background checks, that there have been some changes in what our required disclosures are about adverse action, and a standalone requirement making people applying for jobs truly understand that there may be some credit header data or other data pulled on them. We have certainly gotten plenty of notifications from our data vendors, and I have seen and heard LexisNexis speaking about this as well. But out here in the Ninth Circuit, there are tons of class actions in this area. And Dennis, I didn't know if you wanted to talk about, from a litigation standpoint, some of the concerns about class actions related to the employment context of the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Well, more specifically than just the employment context, I liked us mentioning this because accustomed to the FDCPA, which just relates to collections and agencies collecting, third party, but the FCRA is so much broader, and it can encompass everything from our collection activities to, like Leslie mentioned, our employment activities. And so anytime we're using the credit reporting or the credit information in any way, we have to be very cognizant of that we're following the law. And as Leslie mentioned, that we have policies and procedures in place to make sure our employees, especially new hires, are following the law in the way that we anticipate the law to be followed. FCRA, there are a ton of cases that have nothing to do with the collection industry because of the breadth of the law. And we just need to always be aware of that.
I think just to tag on real quickly, that's a great perspective, Dennis. And I think that sometimes we don't necessarily have the left hand and the right hand communicating, especially, you know, in some of the larger companies. So now would be a great time to check in with your human resources team or talent development team or any of the people that are screening prospective job applicants. If you have a professional employee leasing arrangement or similar, there is no time like the present to take some time to understand what the background checks that you may be performing might involve and what type of data is being used, because people in your organization, or if you use an outside recruitment firm to assist you, they may not completely understand that some of the data that goes into a background check may have been sourced by a credit report.
That's an excellent point, Leslie. I graduated from a business school, and we talked about the FCRA a total of zero times. And while that was a long time ago, FCRA was still in effect. And a lot of HR people, they don't think about it, don't think about the effects. And again, takeaways from a session like this, hopefully, although it doesn't deal with collections, hopefully you can still have a helpful takeaway, a practical takeaway, and how to best protect your business in a maybe untraditional fashion.
So turning back to the BCFP for a minute, the top reasons for credit reporting related complaints that the Bureau receives have pretty much continued to fall into five categories. The first is, of course, there is incorrect information on my credit report. The second is the company that reported stuff on my credit never bothered to investigate, or worse, refused to investigate. The third is that permissible purpose, or the Pintos argument, the collection agency or the creditor made an improper use of my credit report. The fourth most famous reason for a complaint to the Bureau is I can't get my credit report or my credit score. And then finally, credit monitoring or identity protection services have failed me. And I think that one thing that I have found is, very concerning is that there has been a proliferation of credit re-reporters. If people went to Equifax, TransUnion, or Experian websites, there are so many fantastic educational materials and other stuff. But there is, this huge cornucopia of people that are kind of in between the consumer and their own and his or her own credit, who make various promises to the consumer about improving their credit score, removing derogatory trade lines, and things of that nature. And some of them don't purchase data as frequently as perhaps we might wish. So you'll get repeat complaints. You guys have refused to update this trade line on my credit report. And then you find out that it's some service that the consumer is getting their information from, who only buys data every 6 months from the three CRAs. So, I would urge you, FCRA litigation is completely on the uptick. And Dennis can probably tell us a little bit more about the types of cases he's handling in his office right now. But there is truly no time like the present to really look at some of your internal policies and procedures, maybe to look at the addenda you have on your services agreements with your creditor clients about how frequently they report stuff to you, whether or not you're allowed to get information from them to do an investigation, what you have to do if you can't get information from them on a timely basis. But Dennis, let's turn to you for a sec. What are some of the types of really tricky litigation you are finding in the FCRA area?
Well, you talked about reinvestigation, and that's a huge one. I think a lot of times agencies, they get information from their client, and then they rely on it. And oftentimes they rely on it without maybe getting documentation to support the information given. And that's a real danger, because what will happen is they'll be asked for a reinvestigation, and then there'll be a dispute. So during the reinvestigation process, they'll look at their monitor and they'll say, okay, well, says the person owed $1,000. So, okay, that's it. Good. They owed $1,000. That was the number given to us by the creditor. And then that's it. But that can't be it. The law requires more than that. It requires the agency now to dig a little deeper. As a collection attorney, I have to, before I file a lawsuit, I have to have meaningful involvement, meaning that I've looked at documentation that supports the numbers that the creditor says are owed. The agencies don't have a requirement to do that when they're collecting until there's a dispute. And then once there's a dispute, they have that extra requirement of getting a little more involved and looking at data. And so when that occurs, absent doing that, you don't meet your reinvestigation goals, your reinvestigation requirements, and then you're liable under the FCRA. Sometimes though, agencies come back and say, yeah, but Dennis, I can't get it from my client. It's not my fault. And then I say, well, then at that time you've got a dispute and you can't get information that supports the document, supports the reported numbers that you've provided, then you need to delete the account. And the FCRA is very clear about that. If you can't support the number, you need to delete the account. And as far as some of the other claims that you mentioned, like the no permissible purpose, they get a lot of claims on that, but a lot of those are bogus. They're claiming that insurance, the collection agency didn't have a permissible purpose to report, or didn't have a permissible purpose to look at the document, look at the report information. And so those have been pretty bogus claims. It's that reinvestigation part that has been big. And also, a big one is disputes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I apologize. Another big one is disputes. And it's I consider it a low-hanging fruit sort of situation where a dispute will be made, and it isn't the account isn't updated. The credit reporting account isn't updated. That's a pretty easy one for a plaintiff's attorney. And unfortunately, it was easy also for the agency to prevent in the first place. So while you may be scratching your head while I'm saying this, thinking, well, of course we do that. Double check, because a lot of agencies are finding themselves liable for not updating the status of the debt after a dispute occurs, especially within the 30-day window. And it's just one of those things that's easy to prevent, and it may be a problem or an occurrence that happens in your agency that you don't even know is happening in your agency.
Thank you for jumping in with that. I appreciate it. We got an interesting question submitted in advance of today's webinar. And what it asked was for best practices given a certain or different scenarios. So what I'd like to do maybe is just to take a quick break from our discussion and go through these scenarios and maybe get a quick input from either or both of you about what you think the best way to handle these situations are. You receive a dispute and need information from your client, and they have not yet responded within the 30 days. They have a legacy system that the data is coming from. They need to pull a guarantor agreement from storage, etc. How would you recommend the collection?
Before, not the specific question, but this scenario, we both say you have to delete. It's unfortunate, but there's no real other avenue. If you continue without getting that information, you haven't fulfilled your reinvestigation requirement. And while your client may have put you in a bad spot, you're in that spot. You need to delete.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I think that, you know, not just the Bureau, but the Federal Trade Commission also has had some pretty profound enforcement actions in this area, not the least of which was a very detailed consent agreement in the asset acceptance matter in 2012. And not only do our regulators think that we should have an early warning system, so take your fact pattern in your question, Mike, and roll it out. You've had several issues with this creditor getting a quick turnaround on data, or you find you're having a disproportionate number of disputes for a particular creditor's portfolio or recent placement or other early warning systems. It is very clear from everything that the Bureau has written and the Federal Trade Commission has written that they might don't have some sort of follow-up steps to identify a disproportionate number of disputes or things of that nature. They also would consider it to be concerning if you perhaps are not going back to a client who is unable, no matter how legitimate the reason, for providing information quickly and saying, hey, look, guys, we would love to furnish data for you, and we know that's an important part of your strategy. But in order for us to do that by federal law, we have to be able to complete an investigation of any items within 30 days. So maybe we should suspend furnishing data about your accounts until we can work out a better system, you know, to get that quickly. And both the Bureau and the Federal Trade Commission, and probably a lot of state AGs, would agree that your failure to take affirmative action as a data furnisher and go back to your creditor could be problematic for you.
And to add one thing to what Leslie said, and Leslie, those are really good comments. As far as a trend of that creditor, of that client giving you information, that also means you're going to be susceptible to FDCPA lawsuits for reporting the wrong number. And even if you can defend those based upon a reasonable reliance, bona fide error, you still got to spend money on somebody to defend those, and time and effort and resources, and you don't want to do all that. So if you're having a client that's repeatedly not being able to give you information to support the numbers given to you, that is a red flag that can be a problem in a lot of ways, even outside of credit reporting.
Okay, our next scenario. You receive a request to remove a dispute from the credit file, but the person is represented by an attorney and the account is, in fact, disputed by the attorney, but you've already provided verification to the attorney. Any response on how to handle that situation?
I would advise my client to change to not disputed and then follow up with the attorney to say, we were contacted by your client, you know, the agency was contacted by your client saying that the account is no longer in dispute, although you've disputed it in the past. Apparently, after we sent you the verification you were requesting in our reinvestigation, you've realized that it should not be in dispute, which we thought was correct in the first place. So that would be my advice.
Yeah, I agree. And I would also consider training my support people to believe that that fact pattern could potentially be baiting to see if we're going to make a mistake and react directly to the consumer. So I would treat that with kid gloves and do exactly what Dennis said.
You know, this is really, when it comes to disputing, it's not the first answer that counts. It's the last answer that counts. Especially if in this fact pattern, you've already given information. The fact that the answer is changing in your eyes is very reasonable, right? Because you thought you were correct in the first place. Your documentation supports you're correct. And so the fact that this person is now undisputing the account makes a lot of sense. But if you were to ignore the person who's now made that, you know, if you've to ignore the consumer because the attorney had said something in the past, I think you set yourself up for a problem of misrepresenting the account as being disputed when it's really not.
And some of the mortgage underwriter standards changed a few years ago and penalized people who were applying for a refinance or for a mortgage if they had any disputed trade lines on their credit report. So it is possible that a person's attorney might not have realized that at the time at which they disputed and got verification and possibly wouldn't have gone back. So to Dennis's point, if you leave that dispute on the credit file, then you could be opening yourself up to a credit defamation claim or similar, knowing that some of the mortgage underwriters are pretty strict now about any disputed trade lines on a consumer's credit file.
Excellent. Our next scenario, you receive a dispute with the HIPAA and power of attorney signed by a debtor from a credit repair firm alleging you have not responded to their client's dispute with proper validation, including A, B, C, and D, none of which by law you have to provide, but you did verify with the client that the debt is in fact still outstanding and merely credit reported for the past 3 years. The credit repair rep is not an attorney and merely telling you that they are going to advise their client to sue you for violations unless you remove the alleged inaccuracy.
I stand pat. I don't do anything different. if you had, you've already provided the verification, the validation that is necessary under the law, and what's being asked is not required under the law, but is extra, which, by the way, is a request that a lot of my clients get a lot of the time. We don't provide extra things. They'll ask for a list of 30 things, and we need to require two. We'll require the two things. Well, you know, we send what we need to, what we're required to send, and we ignore the rest of it. And that's, and I'll say that's true if it's coming from an attorney or a non-attorney. But specific to this question, though, when a dispute's coming in from a non-attorney, attorney, and we've already sent the information, yeah, I think you can ignore it. It's not the consumer. It's not the attorney. I don't think you have an obligation to respond. What do you think, Leslie?
Well, you know, I can't resist answering any question about HIPAA any time of the day or night. The primarily a healthcare servicer, or revenue cycle healthcare servicer, we rarely see a HIPAA authorization as a component of what a credit repair organization supplies, because that would, of course, require that they actually have a real signature of the consumer on the HIPAA authorization, which is nothing more than a HIPAA-compliant release. So I get very nervous about providing anything that could fall into the protected health information category to a third party, whether it is or isn't within the scope. So typically what we will do if we get a verification request from a CRO or a third party that's not an attorney about a consumer's health information, we'll send a letter to that person saying, under separate cover, we have sent the debt verification to the consumer. It includes, you know, protected health information, and in an excess of caution, you know, we are not going to provide that to you, because there really is no reason whatsoever that you can come up with under HIPAA for a credit repair organization to need information that is within the scope of PHI. And one can even argue that because HIPAA is a series of rules about what permissions you have to use and disclose information in different fact patterns, it's hard to come up with an example where a CRO ever needs a patient's information, whether it is or isn't within the proper scope. So I'd rather comply with HIPAA, even though it has no private cause of action, and err on the side of caution, and provide as little information as is humanly possible back to the third party who's not a lawyer. You know, I think it would be incredibly embarrassing to a consumer, you know, for some of their medical information to be in the hands of CRO when they didn't even realize that an itemized bill might reveal the nature of a diagnosis, even though it technically is a summary bill. You know, anybody who watches The Good Doctor or ER or Chicago Med can probably decode some of the things that are on itemized bills now from hospitals or caregivers. I'm not citing them as authorities. I'm just saying.
Sure. Our next scenario, you receive a dispute on a credit reported account for a common name, but the address doesn't match any of your accounts and there's no social security number or date of birth in the letter to match with.
Yeah, if I don't know who it is, I don't know, we can't really do anything. I mean, so I think the only response is to request more information. If you have, let's say, four different people with the same name in your account, you know, I guess one alternative could be to mark everything disputed. But then once you've done that, you've created an obligation to reinvestigate all those accounts. You've then marked them disputed when maybe three of the four aren't, or maybe all four of them aren't if it's not the right person at all. So I think it's a real danger to do anything until you know who exactly you're talking about. So my practical answer is to request more information.
As a prevention person, I've seen examples where we credit reported or we furnished data about the correct person, but it got picked up by an abstractor somehow and was listed against an incorrect person who lived in the similar area or in the same state even and had the same name. And it caused a lot of harm to this person. And you know, there are things on people's credit files that get on there because abstractors put them on, like judgments, that we don't report. So I guess being a prevention person, I might go the route, if it isn't going to bring my client to its knees, I might go the route of investigating all of them and marking all of the common name accounts as disputed while I try to go back and get more information. And there also are some great commercial products that are available. You know, whenever you go to an industry meeting, you can see that there are some companies that are kind of a middle person between eOSCAR and your own collection system. And they sort of help you to match up potentially accounts that you do have in your system with items that come in through eOSCAR. And sometimes they have some pretty good analytics of their own about stuff like that that can be helpful. I guess I'd always be inclined to err on the side of caution, unless it would torture us because we have 500 credit reported items from the same name, from the same state.
And while I've never seen a lawsuit you know, I've never seen an agency or anybody else get sued for reporting something disputed when it really isn't. I don't know why it would not be a violation, because you are misrepresenting the status of the account. And Leslie, as you mentioned before, I mean, if that were to interfere with some sort of loan application or selling property or whatever, you could have a whole mess on your hands, because you were trying to, even though you in good faith were trying to do the right thing, those good intentions could have led you to an unexpected problem.
Absolutely.
Furniture, for not removing the disputed tag from a trade line.
I've never seen that. Usually, in fact, that's a condition of a settlement or something like that. You know, one thing Leslie and I were talking about, though, in preparation for this, is what happens when you get a question, you know, well, I mean, when you get a dispute and you don't really want to jerk around with this thing anymore. You'd rather just delete the account and return the, you know, delete the trade line, delete the account from your system, sending it back to your client and be done with it. And, you know, Leslie, what do you do in those situations where, you know, do you still have to reinvestigate, or can you just call it a day and move on because you've deleted?
I think that, you know, at some point, some of the analytics people are likely to say, you know, we have spent a lot of time and energy with some of the support on this account. It certainly doesn't appear likely to pay. You know, maybe we're just chasing our tails, and maybe we're better off, you know, deleting and focusing our energies on accounts that we have a greater probability of resolving. You know, you never want to do anything that's untrue or inaccurate. So if you're not doing something that's untrue or inaccurate, it may be that there are different unicorns and rainbows you want to chase that aren't this account.
Not that there's anything wrong with chasing unicorns or rainbows, right?
I like that.
Another question that just came in before we start to wrap things up. My company has had lawsuits filed against us for not removing a dispute. In our case, the credit bureaus never submitted the documents to us showing the dispute was to be removed, so we were not liable, but the bureaus were.
I'm sorry.
It when a lawyer says,
Yes, usually we just make things up instead of saying, But in this instance, I have this experience. I'm glad to hear they weren't liable, though.
Yeah, I think that you know, it's kind of interesting. The bureaus have their own trade association, the CDIA, and this past summer, I had the opportunity to attend some of their meetings with the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection and some AGs and stuff. And I think that the credit reporting agencies look at the world a little bit different than do we. Of course, they expect us to act accurately and things of that nature, and to, you know, have a lot of controls in place. They also get pretty testy with us as data furnishers. If we report a bunch of stuff, and percentage-wise, then we're deleting a bunch of stuff. Dennis and I, when we were preparing for this, also had a conversation about needing to be super extra duper cautious about whether, despite you having no intention in your data furnishing to have something look like a UDAP, the consumer bar is extraordinarily creative in coming up with ideas about things that are, you know, unfair or deceptive. And you might want to take a look at some of the impacts of things you do through the lens of the consumer and ask yourself, might this be considered an unfair or deceptive act or abusive practice?
Some of the comments here that we got are that some other people have had some similar experiences where the information, as soon as they proved the plaintiff's attorney that they weren't given the information by the credit reporting agency, then the case was dismissed. So that's good. So almost a bona fide error of sorts.
Excellent. Well, we've only got a couple minutes left. What I'd like to do maybe is, I know it's December, so it's year end, and everyone's kind of starting to look ahead to 2019. Maybe Dennis and Leslie, you can each spend a minute or two sort of talking about, you know, what you expect in 2019 related to the FCRA, either from a litigation perspective or either, you know, state, federal action or activity perspective. Leslie, maybe you can start us off.
Sure. And there is one question we didn't get to in the queue I want to answer because I am old enough to know the answer. And that question, isn't it a violation to report a debt as disputed when it's not? I have waited all hour for a question I know the answer to. No, I'm just kidding. It's a great question. And in the olden days, somebody had the idea in the industry to just report everything as disputed right out of the gate and then save yourself the trouble of really needing to investigate anything. And that yielded quite a number of class action lawsuits because, of course, all the plaintiff's lawyers have to do is find the needle in the needle stack, that one person who really would never have disputed their trade line, and then you've got a world of hurt. So if you know that an account is truly not disputed, it's probably a really bad idea to report it as disputed. It not only could subject you to FDCPA litigation, but it also could catch the attention of a regulator who doesn't like the idea of a shortcut that you may have taken, no matter how well you can explain it. So that's a really good question, and thank you for asking that, Mr. Coleman. So what does my crystal ball say? My crystal ball says that the Attorney General's compact about medical debt may continue to get some traction after the new Congress is seated. I don't know that we'll see too much lame duck activity going on, and I would watch for that. There also is a bill coming from Luke DeMeyer's office that is going to seek to preempt all the state laws in certain types of data security breach notifications. I think that would be very interesting from a red flags perspective and is something to keep an eye on. My goodness, it would certainly make a lot of people's lives a lot easier. So that's what I see in my crystal ball. What about you, Dennis?
Well, speaking of AG offices, one of the biggest things I see is a growing coordination between AG offices, the Bureau, and other regulators. They are beginning to really try to understand what problem areas the other has so that everybody can look at everything. And so one thing that you may want to be very cognizant of is when you're seeing looking at AG actions in one state, to not be surprised if your attorney general may be looking at the same thing. So and that's not just with FCRA, that's with anything. So that's that growing coordination is something to really pay attention to.
Excellent. Well, yeah, go ahead. Someone wanted to say something else?
I think that's a great point. And I think that as more and more of the state regulators continue to sign on to the NMLS, there are back office features to that software program that allow the regulators to see all the complaints that licensed agencies have in various states. So I would expect them to collaborate also, Dennis. So that's an excellent point.
And Mike, if anybody had any questions that were unanswered during this, I'm sure Leslie and I would be happy to try to answer and get those people their answers.
Absolutely. People can just reach out to me and I'll be happy to forward those requests on to Dennis and Leslie to see if they can take care of it. Dennis, Leslie, thank you very much for your time and your insights today. Really appreciate all this great information on a very important and complex topic. I also want to thank LexisNexis Risk Solutions one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to risk.lexisnexis.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. Really appreciate your interest. A recording of this will be posted to accountsrecovery.net. Webinars in the very near future. I hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.